Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 43. Josephine Woodbury Again. Whatever peace Mrs. Eddy attained at almost any period of her life, but especially in her latter years, was attained in spite of, rather than because of, circumstances. It is true that she was now surrounded by faithful friends and helpers, and that she was daily the recipient of messages of gratitude and loyalty from all over the world. Yet hardly a week passed but that some friend disappointed her, or some trusted lieutenant failed in a given task, or someone she had long striven to help finally fell away. Worse still, others proved to be sources of great embarrassment. A notable instance of this last was Josephine Woodbury, who here, once again, makes a rather tragic entrance. Mrs. Eddy had no doubt gone far out of the way to keep this spectacularly unconventional student in the fold and out of the public limelight. Despite the notoriety occasioned by her housetop proclamation 2 years before that her child had been virginally conceived, when the church was reorganized in 1892, her application for membership was accepted, albeit conditionally. Incidentally, this ingenious device of keeping a member in line by placing him on probation instead of excluding him was to be employed thereafter by the church with astonishing success in case after case, although it must be admitted that it failed in this instance. The irrepressible Josephine was not to be easily harnessed. Before very long, she was found to be involved in two lawsuits, one with a certain Fred D. Chamberlain, who charged her with alienating his wife's affections, and the other a divorce action brought by a Mrs. Evelyn I. Rowe on the grounds that her husband had been devoting practically all his earnings to the support of Mrs. Woodbury's son, the little Prince of Peace. The Boston Traveler published a spicy and embroidered article on these affairs. But Mrs. Woodbury was not the type to submit to ridicule without a fight. Greatly daring, she brought action against the Traveler for libel. This, Mrs. Eddy indicated by one of those sternly inexorable letters which she knew so well how to write when faced with an impasse, was the last straw. How dare you, in the sight of God, and with your character behind the curtain of your students, ready to lift it on you, pursue the path perilous, she demanded. Swiftly, then, the church acted, and Mrs. Woodbury was forever excommunicated, a notice to this effect being inserted in the journal for June 1896. Her libel suit against the newspaper collapsed, and she found herself ostracized by the world she had built up for herself. Adrift in what must have seemed a desolate and uncharted sea. But Josephine Woodbury had been taught there was no living without religion, and no religion without a church, and so it was not long before she hired rooms in the Legion of Honor Hall in Boston, and there, every Sunday afternoon, she and her daughter, Gwendolyn, preached to a group of followers and others to the number of some 150. The following year, namely 1897, about the time of the gathering at Concord, recorded in the last chapter, Mrs. Woodbury published a pamphlet entitled War in Heaven. In this, she gave what purported to be an account of her experiences in Christian Science. Later on still, she published a series of articles in The Arena, in which she launched an attack on Mrs. Eddy, which for simple violence had hardly been equaled up to that time. She ridiculed the English in Science and Health, accused Mrs. Eddy of trafficking in the temple, and with fine indignation charged her with teaching the doctrine of spiritual conception. Mrs. Eddy's title, discoverer and founder of Christian Science, she derided as paradoxical, saying, "Surely a discoverer cannot be the founder of that which she has been under the necessity of discovering, while a founder would have no need of discovering her own foundation." She insisted that all she had discovered were ways of perverting and prostituting the science of healing to her own ecclesiastical aggrandizement, and to the moral and physical depravity of her dupes. "What she has founded," she added, "is a commercial system, monumental in its proportions, but already tottering to its fall." Another unfortunate excursion into prophecy. Mrs. Eddy, in the course of her message to the Mother Church, delivered on June 4, 1899, and later republished in her book Miscellany, made a statement which, although it did not mention Mrs. Woodbury by name, was construed by her and her followers into a direct attack. "The doom of the Babylonish woman," Mrs. Eddy declared, referred to in Revelation, "is being fulfilled. This woman, drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, drunk with the wine of her fornication, would enter even the church, the body of Christ, truth, and retaining the heart of the harlot and the purpose of the destroying angel, would pour wormwood into the waters, the disturbed human mind, to drown the strong swimmer struggling for the shore, aiming for truth, and if possible, to poison such as drink of the living water." Josephine Woodbury was outraged. Within a few weeks, she brought a suit of libel against Mrs. Eddy. Mrs. Eddy, in her reply, maintained that, in speaking as she did, she was dealing with a situation, not a person, and that in mentioning the Babylonish woman, she had been speaking not of an individual, but of a type. Mrs. Eddy called to Boston her foremost disciples, including Mrs. Stetson, and Mr. Kimball to handle mentally this new crisis. There were many delays, but when the action did come up, the court dismissed the case at the end of the plaintiff's evidence. That, as far as Mrs. Woodbury was concerned, was the end. Insisting that she was being mentally hounded by Mrs. Eddy and her followers, and in serious danger of her life, she declined to appeal, as some of her friends wished her to do. And shortly afterwards, she withdrew definitely and finally from the scene to live out her days in England. Such an incident, dragging itself out anxiously over the weeks and months and even years, was only one of many with which Mrs. Eddy and her movement were beset in these years. Almost every issue of the journal contains some reference to cases wherein Christian Science practitioners had been haled before the courts, charged with the unlicensed practice of medicine, with manslaughter, and so forth. It is true that practically all such cases resulted in acquittal, and that some of the decisions later became historic, establishing precedents for the future. But for the much enduring woman at Concord, they must have represented only trial added to trial of faith and patience. And she had had so many. Nevertheless, looking back on it all in the perspective of the years, the outstanding feature of these times, as far as the Christian Science movement was concerned, was sustained and amazing growth. And if this record were a history of the movement rather than a biography of its founder, it would be necessary to travel far afield to get a true picture, year by year, of what was happening. For at the turn of the century, Christian Science had literally spread all over the world. The Journal for March 1900 shows Christian Science practitioners established in Sofia, Bulgaria, Peking, China, in Hawaii and the Philippines, in Australia, England, France, and Germany. Within a few years, Mark Twain, one of its most caustic critics, was to admit that it was spreading at the rate, as he put it, of a new church every 4 days. And Mrs. Eddy at Pleasant View never lost touch with any of it. More and more did those around her seek to take over routine business and as much else as possible. But that Mrs. Eddy kept in touch with anything and everything that had any important bearing on the spiritual or physical growth of the movement is amply shown by her letters and messages. Always she had been a remarkable correspondent. And although now she dictated a good deal, yet even at 80 and afterwards, she spent long hours each day at her desk, writing letters, messages, articles for the Journal or Sentinel, or working at a task which was never done, revising Science and Health. It had become a practice, when a new church was built and dedicated, to write to Mrs. Eddy, notifying her of the fact, and inviting her, no matter what the distance, to be present. Mrs. Eddy always replied to the invitation, personally, either by letter or by telegram. And these letters to churches are today among the best known of her shorter writings. They cover a wide field, from a nearby town such as Lawrence, Massachusetts, to San Jose in California, Toronto, Canada, Sydney, Australia, or London or Edinburgh. Several of them were published in her book, Miscellaneous Writings, which appeared in the spring of 1897. But most of them appear in her book, The First Church of Christ Scientist and Miscellany, published shortly after her death. One of the most interesting of these letters is that written to the church in her own Concord on the occasion of its final organization, February 1899. It was at a time, as has been seen, when newspaper attacks on Mrs. Eddy and her teaching were particularly virulent. Josephine Woodbury was preparing her broadsides in the arena, and a few months previously had published her War in Heaven. And so, Mrs. Eddy's letter to the Concord Church is full of exhortation to patience and to a recognition of the fact that those who attacked them did so, for the most part, in ignorance, and were deserving of compassion rather than resentment. She herself had patience, she said, with the attacks of the newspapers, because she sympathized with their ignorance of Christian Science, and because she knew that no Christian can or does understand this science and not love it. Rest assured, she added, that the injustice done by press and pulpit to this denomination of Christians will cease when it no longer blesses this denomination. Yet, in spite of the bitterness of the attacks upon her from without, Mrs. Eddy was even more beset with adulation from within. Her writings maintained that, as far as her followers were concerned, while attacks would only serve to strengthen them, deification of herself was only a hindrance, if not a fatal obstacle to progress. Her letters and writings about this time are full of exhortations against personal attachment to herself. Her teaching could not be expected to survive if a person were to displace principle for the student. Those who look for me in person or elsewhere than in my writings lose me instead of find me, she wrote to one correspondent. And in a vigorous article entitled Personal Contagion, published in the journal, she said, there was never a religion or philosophy lost to the centuries, except by sinking its divine principle in personality. And then she adds in a passage, eloquent of patience sorely tried, I left Boston in the height of prosperity to retreat from the world, and to seek the one divine person, whereby and wherein to show others the footsteps from sense to soul. To give me this opportunity is all that I ask of mankind. But it was a problem to be taken up again and again. All her life, she had been particularly sensitive to human affection. And for years, in spite of repeated betrayals and pitiful failing, she had accepted it with new hope whenever it had been sincerely offered. And so, in these times of adulation and hero worship, she often found it hard to deprive others of what apparently meant so much to them. An interesting instance is afforded in an article published in the Journal for June 1899 by one Martha Sutton Thompson, giving an account of a visit she paid to Boston and Concord. She had come to Boston for the purpose of attending a class in Christian Science. And after describing how much she kept hoping that before the class was over, Mrs. Eddy herself might come to see them, she goes on to tell how when the class had come to an end without Mrs. Eddy's appearing, she and her friend determined to go to Concord in the hope of catching a glimpse of their leader. They were successful, for she writes, "The following day, five of us made the journey to Concord, drove out to Pleasant View, and met her face to face on her daily drive. She seemed watching to greet us, for when she caught sight of our faces, as our carriage turned a little, she instantly half rose with expectant face, bowing, smiling, and waving her hand to each of us. Then, as she went out of sight, kissed her hand to all." The writer then goes on to describe what it all meant to her. And when it is remembered that Mrs. Eddy was in daily receipt of letters from all quarters expressing similar sentiments, it is not difficult to understand how she might be torn between a desire to reciprocate it all unrestrainedly in kind and a recognition of the fact that undue devotion to personality was one of the great foes to progress. I will not attempt to describe the leader, Martha Sutton Thompson wrote, nor can I say what this brief glimpse was and is to me. I can only say I wept, and the tears start every time I think of it. Why do I weep? I think it is because I want to be like her, and they are tears of repentance. I realize now what it was that made Mary Magdalene weep when she came into the presence of the Nazarene. It was not his personality. Towards affection such as this, Mrs. Eddy was full of compassion. At any rate, there was here some semblance of an attempt to look away from effect to cause. But there was another kind of gratitude towards which Mrs. Eddy always showed herself stern and relentless. "A person wrote to me," she writes in the journal, "naming the time of the occurrence. I felt the influence of your thought on my mind, and it produced a wonderful illumination, peace, and understanding. But I had not thought of the writer at that time. When will the world cease to judge of causes from a personal sense of things, conjectural and misapprehensive? And so it went. The pathway of what the world would call success was no more easy for this woman than the long road of toil and struggle she had traversed in the earlier days of her pilgrimage.